Hello, thank you very much for downloading this week's edition of the Click podcast with Gareth and Bill back again as well. I hope you're well, Bill.
I am, thank you. Yes, and, nice to be back in the studio.
Nice to have you back. We were talking games last week on our games special, and I think a lot of people, including me, wants to know what your favourite game is, if you have one, Bill.
I'm not really a gamer, which is probably a good reason I wasn't on the gaming special, actually. Yeah, my favourite game is probably this thing called Twitter. It's amazing. What you get is all these computer-generated characters send random messages to you and you have to respond to them, and if you're funny or witty or you know, informative, you get points. It's brilliant.
Do you think it'll catch on? It sounds like a kind of multi-user experience.
Well, I'm playing in single user at the moment, so obviously I mean might go multi-user one day.
Right, if you end up with a second Twitter profile or something. Other people have been telling us since last week's programme about their favourite games. Stuart Pask says, the best game ever for me has to be Left 4 Dead. It's an online cooperative zombie shooter where you and three friends play online to survive the zombie apocalypse. And Mardi Farikia says that he still loves the popular aeroplane game on the old Atari game stations, but he's also into modern era gaming, as he calls it, with the likes of FIFA and Need for Speed. Also, we were playing, do you remember the game Axon that we talked about a few weeks ago?
Growing nerves.
Absolutely, growing neurons. And on air, I was saying how I'd got up to 25,000 micrometres and challenging people on Facebook, on our Facebook listeners group, to beat me. Paul Dwyer's got to 25,681 and growing, he says. But that's nothing compared to Gonzalo San Martin, who's up to 47,894.
Clearly doesn't have a radio programme to make.
I think so. But he's a useful chap to have around if you need neurons making or something like that. Speaking of making a radio programme, I think that's what we'd better do. Here comes the show. Hello everyone, I'm Gareth Mitchell and this is Click. Today, an antisocial manifesto, also simulating the choppy waters off Auckland for sailors who are unable to use their limbs. And one of the world's biggest computing challenges steps up a gear. Well, it's not just me, of course. Bill is here as ever. Hello Bill, how are you?
Hello there, Gareth, I'm very well, thank you.
Nice to have you back again this week after your absence last week as well.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no worries, I was just saying, it's just good to see you. So, what we're going to ask you to do, not just you, Bill, but everyone out there in Radioland as well, is to stop what you're tweeting and Facebooking and just listen to this. Because it's time to pause for thought for a moment about the benefits and the dangers of the connected society. I've paused for quite a few moments over the last couple of days to read Silicon Valley controversialist Andrew Keen's latest book, Digital Vertigo. The gist of Keen's argument is that we're fracturing our identities by unthinkingly sharing so much through the social media, and it's to our cost as individuals and as a society, and to the profit of the Facebooks of this world. So that's the gist of it then, Andrew. And can we just talk about what the cost is to us? Because many of us think of using Facebook, for instance, as being free.
Yeah, nothing is ever free. I think anyone who uses the internet should have learned that by now. And hopefully my book will help them understand it if they don't already know it. When you use Facebook, you're giving Facebook all your personal data. And that's why a company which doesn't have much technology of its own is being valued at about $100 billion.
And I suppose it's quite telling, isn't it, that people seem to be prepared to pay for these services by submitting their data, information about themselves. It's almost as if that is worth less than the money in their pockets to people. And do you find that rather, you know, are you dismayed by that?
Well, I one of the reasons I wrote the book was to remind people that free isn't really free, and that I'd like to see the development of business models for social networks where people pay for these services and where companies really can honestly focus on protecting the absolute privacy of its users' data. And you're beginning to see some of these companies in Silicon Valley. I think we're at the beginning of a reaction against certainly Facebook and some of these other more open free networks. So hopefully it will add to that debate.
And what do you mean then by this fractured identity then? Is it the idea that so much of our kind of personalities, our identities exist in the digital space and are shared openly with everybody else that we almost, I don't know, forget who we are, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we forget who we are. It's the book is about losing what it means to be human, losing the inner life that we've spent several hundred years developing and protecting, the inner life of the individual, by publicly broadcasting ourselves so shamelessly, or many of us, by revealing everything about ourselves, by living so publicly. I think we are thinning out our humanness. We are simplifying it. And I think that ultimately we will regret that, particularly if we continue to do it. There's an endless debate in Silicon Valley about whether privacy is dead. I don't think it's quite dead yet, but it's not in a great condition. Right. So I want to make sure that we can get it off life support.
Okay, and you'd say it's about striking the right balance, which you'd agree with, wouldn't you, Bill? I mean, you know, we share, but we share, I suppose, carefully and
thoughtfully. Well, I don't share that carefully anymore. And I think Andrew makes a very good point, which is that the commercial incentive for companies to make us share more and more and more is distorting what we can get out of social media. I just think you take your fear of that, and that then distorts your view of the possible benefits of social media. So although I enjoyed the book, it seems to me that your concerns about the business models of Facebook and LinkedIn and people like that make you look too harshly on the benefits that can come from sharing and from use of social media.
I think that's a fair criticism, Bill. All your criticisms are always fair. Although the last thing anyone needs is a book from me telling them how wonderful social media is.
Absolutely.
And my book, Digital Vertigo, is not like The Cult of the Amateur. It's not saying that the internet is trashing our society. I'm not arguing we should all get off these networks. I'm on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook. But it does attempt to take a more nuanced, critical view of these networks and of their cultural, their social, their commercial implications, particularly for the individual.
And just quickly, and this is the question you always get asked, but people have a choice, don't they? You know, we can just say we can just opt out of all this if we want to, or can we?
I get this question all the time, and I'm not sure if we can. As we have this shift from a Web 2.0 link economy dominated by Google to a Web 3.0 big data economy of likes shaped by Facebook, increasingly Facebook is the front door on the internet. If you, I just did a piece for The Atlantic on serendipity, and I was using some of these social location services like Sonar and Highline. And to get on those networks or to get on Zynga, you've got to be on Facebook. So it's increasingly hard to operate, to find your way around the internet without being on Facebook.
That's absolutely right, of course. If you want to use the Spotify service these days, you have to have a login in Facebook. So increasingly, we're not allowed to make the choices that we feel we should be able to make. And I think that's one of the strongest issues in Andrew's book, and it's something that really matters to me too.
All right, thanks for that, Bill, and also to you, Andrew. Thanks very much for coming in. Andrew Keane here on Click from the BBC in London. I'm Gareth Mitchell. We're out now onto the choppy waters off Auckland in New Zealand. Sailors have been taking to the seas over there, and it's quite a skill, sailing with all those ropes to pull and sails to set, to say nothing of keeping the boat on the right heading amid unpredictable winds. A bit like being within the social media in many ways. But anyway, staying on course and keeping it steady, in this case, are actually people with severe disabilities who can't use or have difficulty using their arms and their legs. Well, our man in New Zealand is Simon Morton, and he's been to see how it's all done, and he's been finding out that before the sailors do head to open water, they rack up a few virtual nautical miles on dry land in a specially built simulator. Organising it all is Brendan Turrell of the non-profit Sailability Auckland.
It's actually a big jump for somebody that has a spinal cord injury or that is in a wheelchair to actually go, oh, I'm going to get on a boat and go sailing, or what happens if it tips over, or which is what every person goes through, but there's just that extra level of apprehension if you've got a disability and you've already gone through hardships in life.
Hannah Ellis is a walking tetraplegic, and she sat in the cockpit of the sailing simulator at the Auckland Spinal Unit. She's hoping to beat her best time on the virtual course that we can see on the large flat panel TV screen in front of us.
3, 2... There goes the gun.
So how are you going, Hannah?
Yep, I'm going good. It takes a lot of concentration, but very accurate as to what a sailing boat is like. We've been in the water about 3 or 4 times in the sailboat, and I'm very glad that I've had a chance to be in the simulator before getting thrown into a sailboat.
So how long does it take here on the simulator to actually get the skills that are required to then go out into the open water?
All 5 of the people that have processed onto the water so far have either done it in 6 or 7 goes.
And what technology is at play here? Because we look at the screen there and we've got a sort of a graphical view as if we're sat in a yacht looking out at the ocean.
It's actually run by just a computer here, which is plugged into the machine. And on the back here, you'll see the RAM that's tilting the boat side to side. So she steers exactly the same as a boat. She's got a rope in her hand that simulates pulling the sail in and out. So as she pulls that rope, the sail is actually being adjusted on the screen. So Hannah's just coming up now and to the finish line. She's been beaten by her previous
time.
So you'll see as she crosses the finish line on this. Even though she ends up being in second place, she still gets applause from the simulator.
We've moved from the spinal unit and we're down on Auckland's waterfront. It's a blustery old day and I'm with Steve Cranch from Sailability Auckland. You're a sailing instructor, Steve, and you've stuck something around my neck, which is another layer of technology that is seeing people get onto the water.
What we've just put around your neck today is a control box that helps disabled sailors to get out on the water and enjoy some sailing.
Now let's have a go describing it, because the first thing is that there's a sort of almost like a straw-like mechanism that's coming off that's very near my mouth.
It is indeed a straw. The idea of the straw is it's connected to a couple of switches inside the grey plastic box, and these turn the winches on and off in the boat, which controls the sails. So simply by sipping or puffing, you can control winches in the boat are operating the sails. There's also, you'll notice on that box in front of you, is a funny knob sticking up which you can operate with your chin. Once the sailor is in the boat and all fitted up and plugged in, then we can push them off and they can steer by moving their chin left and right and control the sails individually. They can turn either the main on and off by sipping or puffing on the straw, or they can turn the jib on and off. So simply pull the sails in or out. You just move your chin on the what essentially looks like a game controller, basically, but one that you operate with your chin.
Can we actually have a go and see it in action?
Absolutely. Let's plug you in.
Okay, so I'm going to use my chin here.
Yep.
And this is left.
That's right.
And I can see the tiller. Yeah, very obviously moving there. Now, can we have a go with the sip and puff technology?
Yes.
Because I'm intrigued to see how this is going to work.
Absolutely. Well, if you just try puffing on that straw, and you will have seen immediately a little red light popped up on the box.
Oh, yeah, I heard a click as well.
Yep.
So it's main on. That's the main sail is now on.
That's the main sail.
And now I use the chin.
So now you use the chin. If you push away from you, you immediately see you're letting the sail out. This technology allows the sailors to compete with able-bodied sailors and to race competitively, which is a fantastic thing.
That report from Simon Morton in New Zealand. So how about that for an interface, though, Bill?
It is. I mean, this is the thing. We've reached the point now where computers can be used to give us interfaces to almost any bits of technology, and a sailboat is just a very fantastic piece of technology. My partner, Katie, is a serious sailor. She does ocean yachts, and so she would love this sort of thing because it so ties into the ability to control a device using whatever skills or abilities you have. And I think apart from the great thing that it's allowing these sailors to get out there on the water, it's also a good example for people who are designing user interfaces for people who would call themselves able-bodied, that you need to think really carefully when you're building any interface about the capabilities of the users.
And two elements of technology as well, obviously the interface for controlling the boat itself, but then the simulation leading up to it, taking the sailors into the virtual world before trying it out on the open water.
Yeah, and you can now just do that with almost anything. I mean, it would be interesting to ask the sailors to compare to see whether they really felt they were being properly trained or whether they've just been given a sense of the controls and it was completely different when they got onto the water.
No, absolutely. And I do love that sailor in the piece who says, that was a rubbish time that I've just achieved as well. So that competitive spirit comes out on the simulator as well. Well, finally, how about this for a challenge? How do you handle 1 petabyte of data? Now, that's actually 4,000 years worth of Click podcast. Yes, we've done the sums. The other way of thinking about that, a petabyte, is the entire render of the movie Avatar. So a lot of data. So imagine handling that every second. But that is the challenge at the particle physics lab CERN when its detectors are at full speed churning out data from the collisions in the Large Hadron Collider. Much of that torrent is filtered out on the spot. Not even CERN can process and store that much information. But dealing with what's left remains one of the world's biggest computer challenges. And CERN has been working with some major IT companies on it all through its CERN Open Lab initiative. It incorporates massive data centres both at CERN itself and around the world through a distributed computing infrastructure called The Grid. And the partnership has just launched its next phase as the search for the Higgs boson continues. Soon after the launch, I heard more from Bob Jones, head of CERN Open Lab.
In 2011, we recorded something like 22 petabytes of physics data from the LHC, and that's going to increase as the machine performance improves. The amount of data that is produced by the machine, the amount of data which is recorded by the LHC experiments as well, will increase.
You mentioned there a figure of 22 petabytes. So what is this, the amount of data that's produced in a certain amount of time whilst these experiments are running?
Yes, yeah, so that was the amount of data we took in 2011. It was a lot more than we originally thought about, and we know it's going to increase in the future.
And I've been to CERN and seen the amount of in-house processing that you have. The data is obviously coming out incredibly quickly, and there's a certain amount of processing that has to be done near the detectors because everything happens so quickly. Can we say that this is the world's biggest and fastest computing challenge, or at least one of them?
In terms of scientific data that's collected, it's by far the scientific instrument that produces the most amount of data at that sort of rate. That's going to be true for several years, I think, in the future. But we are working a lot with labs from other disciplines. When one thinks of something like next generation genome analysis and so on, with a number of machines which are installed all over the world in different labs, if you want to take all of that data and assemble it together and store it together, in the end, that's likely to probably produce more data than the LHC.
Yeah, because obviously CERN is known as being the birthplace of the World Wide Web. So an example of how computing advances in CERN spilled out into the wider world. How about this then? You're talking about grid computing, this incredibly fast processing, huge amounts of storage. Is any of that going to spill over into the outside world as well, benefiting computer users like, I don't know, say me?
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. You mentioned grid computing. If you look at now the sort of cloud computing, which the man in the street is often using already in terms of storing their photographs, accessing various social media sites and so on, the cloud computing technologies are based on similar technologies which were sort of pioneered in the grid computing environment. So we see already a lot of benefit for society in general in terms of the IT technologies coming out of things like the LHC program. I think certainly in the area of security, we'll be doing a lot of work around security of devices that are connected to the internet, which is of concern to everybody, even if it's to the level of making sure that your identity isn't stolen or that your photographs are really attributed to you and not used for alternative purposes. And the other area that we'll be looking into as well, which is business analytics. With the incredible amounts of data that are coming up now, we have to think of what other added value we can get from analysing that massive amount of data.
Bob Jones at CERN. And sometimes we do like to indulge ourselves with superlatives on this show, Bill. You know, say one of the world's biggest data processing and storage challenges. Sounds great, really.
It does. I've been to the CERN data centre. I've
stood in it. Yeah, me too.
Just the sound of the cooling fans and all of those processors and all those hard drives and all of that tape is astonishing. Any geek should try to get there. It's just a transcendent experience.
Absolutely. And actually, I've been there as well, and I've seen these racks of equipment full of servers, computers, wearing cooling fans and all that kind of stuff. But some of the racks were left free. And I said to these people, I said, but, why haven't you finished it off? And they said, well, it's Moore's Law. We have to keep these free. Otherwise, we end up with a load of equipment that becomes obsolete by the time it actually gets commissioned.
And that's a very big part of how CERN thinks. They're always looking to the future. And it's a massive multi-billion euro, multi-year project. And, of course, although they do great physics there, and the hunt for the Higgs boson is really important, it's not all about the physics. The breakthroughs in material sciences, in superconductors, in how to build the LHC were enormous, and the breakthroughs in computing. The grid is an astonishing achievement. All the scientists at CERN are doing a great job, but the people who actually support them in doing that job are equally important. And what I think is important about this CERN Open Lab is that's the way this sort of gets out into the wider technology community, into the wider world. And, cloud computing services, organisations like Facebook, they're all going to benefit from the work that CERN's doing now in building computing infrastructure.
Don't say Facebook in front of Andrew Keane. Bill, thank you very much indeed. That's it for us for this week. But from me and Bill and obviously producer Fiona Roberts, thank you very much for listening. Bye for now. Well, we're still here, and actually still here with Andrew Keane. And I think the last time we met in the flesh, as it were, was at South by Southwest, the interactive festival in Austin, Texas. And In your book, you talk a lot about one of your sparring partners, really, Clay Shirky, you know, so the here comes everybody person, you know, very much the opposite of you, very into the social, into the sharing. And I remember meeting you at South By, and I think we sat together in a little corner of the press room, and there was something a bit solitary about the way that you were sitting there. An hour later, I was out on 6th Street, Party Central in Austin. I was just about to do a bit of filming for Television Click, bumped, of course, into Clay Shirky, who immediately told me where all the parties were, where to hang out and so on. And it's that image, that anecdote that I had in my head all the way through reading your book, which I have to say I enjoyed reading very much as well.
Well, no, Andrew was definitely the centre of social life yesterday, because he and I were at an event in the UK yesterday called Google's Big Tent, and he had loads of people buzzing around him. So clearly whatever was going on in South By is now repaired.
And you bring up Clay. I think that's an interesting... I have a great deal of respect for Clay, both in professional terms and in personal terms. I like him very much. I think he's... really the smartest guy on the other side. The fact I pick on him in my book means that I take his work really seriously, and I've read his work and I've done a lot of debates with him. I actually think that Clay, as a theorist, I'm critical of Clay, but Clay also isn't on Twitter. Clay doesn't reveal as much about himself, certainly as somebody like Jeff Jarvis, who wears a lot of his inner life much more dramatically than somebody like Clay. So even Clay is more complex than he seems.
And I know that within your book, I mean, you mentioned sort of Jeff Jarvis as well, and you've had a good old sparring match with Jeff Jarvis on this program as well. So these are all people that you respect
and like.
Sure, and hang out with as well. And,
right.
And you are also very interested in this idea of the individual then. Just talk us through that. What's so special about the individual as opposed to maybe just, you know, belonging to a kind of wider society?
What is that a serious question, Gareth? What's so special about the individual?
No, he's doing BBC stuff, you see, because Gareth has to be the balanced in the middle. So,
okay, Bill.
So he's pitching you a question so that you can respond to it without actually letting his viewpoint...
We'll rephrase it, Bill, and you don't have to be BBC.
Well, no, but I do have to be balanced and fair and all those fine things, as you know.
Well, you fundamentally, you can just sit here and talk about me as we go along.
No, that's okay. Well, you see, Gareth we'd like to think that there's something going on in Gareth's head, but of course that's just speculation on our part. Because we can never get into the mind of the other.
And Gareth, by the way, listeners, isn't smiling at that.
I think it was, actually.
But I mean, because for me, one of the issues around your book, I think, is your understanding of the nature of the individual within society. And I come from a philosophical perspective which sees the individual as being something which is carved out of the wider society, that in a sense we don't exist when we're on our own. And you seem to take the individual as being the centre of the argument, and you argue that diluting our individuality by oversharing on social networks, by being part of Facebook's marketing strategy, by being targets for Google ads, is something which damages our individual nature. Now, I think we both agree that that sort of thing is dangerous. I just think we see a different focal point for the danger. I think it's actually dangerous to society that everybody's like that, rather than to the individual per se, whereas you're starting from the point of view of the individual.
Well, let me respond to that in a couple of ways. There has been this endless debate about the value of the individual versus the value of society ever since the Greeks started to think about the individual in society. Indeed, the debate between Aristotle and Plato is one that I kind of refer to in the book. And I think they're both credible. They're the core political theories in the Western tradition. And I tend to be much more in the individual camp. I use Mill, for example, as an anchor in my book, John Stuart Mill's book on liberty.
Yeah, you keep coming back to him. He's your touch point.
He's a touch point because he adds to the narrative, because I can contrast him with Jeremy Bentham and the Panopticon and all that sort of thing. But to be fair, certainly to Mill, just because you support the individual doesn't make you a libertarian. I think the argument I would make, certainly on this show, and I hope I allude to it at least in my book, is that strong individuals make strong societies. And I fear that in our age of social media, the individual's becoming increasingly fragmented. And weak individuals, therefore, are creating a weak society. I also think there is a backlash against what I call the cult of the social. It's coming not from the internet, but from other thinkers and writers. Susan Cain's book, for example, Quiet, has done extremely well, a defense of the introvert, an attack on the idea that we need to be extrovert and continually in a social environment. And she's not against society, but she's just reminding us that real, and she uses the example of Steve Wozniak in her book, real innovation comes from a Wozniak who sits doing the night shift, inventing the personal computer. And even Jonah Lehrer's new book on creativity, on imagination, whilst he pays some credit to the social, does focus on the individual. So this is a key issue. If we are to have a really innovative society, should we be protecting the individual more? I think in my book, I focus also on enterprise tools.
Right. Because Andrew, I mean, one reading that I took away from your book was that and hopefully you will think this is a serious question, it's certainly meant to be, that this is an important time in history just to pause for thought. Maybe even sort of younger people might be advised to read the book just to understand what the dangers of leaving the digital footprint might be, even if it's just something as simple as being aware that, you know, what you tweet or what the photos you put up today can be read by potential employers and so on tomorrow.
Yeah, I don't want to make the argument purely generational. I think if you do, if it's me as an old guy complaining about young people, no one's going to take it seriously. I certainly hope young people will read the book, and I hope they'll respond. I'm on Twitter, AJ Keen. But it should give. We are living at a very interesting moment. I mean, everyone always says we live through these interests. Anyone would acknowledge. I mean, everyone always says, well, we're living at this critical moment in history. But there is this fundamental shift, a cultural socioeconomic shift from an industrial society to a digital knowledge society. And the issue of the kind of society we have, of our relationships, of the community, and of how to protect the individual in the digital age, I think, is critical. And the purpose of the book is to remind people that the individual does need to be protected in the digital age. We're creating a network. Now there's 2 or 3 billion people on it. You know, in a few years, there'll be 6 or 7 billion. It's a network that's increasingly transparent, one where it's increasingly hard to hide. And I think that we need to reintroduce technologies which enable solitude and privacy on the network, because otherwise we're doing ourselves as a species a disservice.
Okay, well, we're going to seek some solitude now. We're going to call it a day for the podcast. Andrew, thank you very much for coming in and for talking to us in the outro.
Thank you, Andrew. Good to see you again.
You see, I am quite social.
Absolutely.